Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Back in the 1970s, I just wanted to tell you this, back in the 1970s, or it could have been the 1980s, it's hard to tell the difference anymore, but American churches fell under the spell of the Bill Gaither family trio. Anyone familiar with that name? Anybody remember that name? The Gaithers? American churches fell under the spell of the Gaithers and their country gospel sound. If you weren't attending hymn-singing churches then, you probably won't know what I'm talking about here. But it had the effect of changing us all from the classic, rigid, hymnic, amazing grace-style hymns and the militant, anthemic, a mighty fortress is our God type of hymns to a more popular 70s mustached, bell-bottom-wearing style, which sounded less like church and more like happy hour with a lounge singer at a hotel bar, and we felt that this was a great improvement, that a great improvement had been made. And one of the most famous contributions along these lines was a country gospel number called The Family of God. It's still a favorite in many churches. The chorus saying, "I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. I've been washed in the fountain, cleansed by his blood, joint heirs with Jesus." You can almost hear it, right? You can maybe recognize that a little bit, and so forth. Perhaps you know it. But the first verse goes, you will notice that we say brother and sister around here. I always think of these words. This song has stayed with me all these years. You will notice we say brother and sister around here. It's because we're a family and these are so near. And when one has a heartache, we all share the tears and rejoice in each victory in this family so dear. I never cared for that song. But it succinctly expresses the sentiment we encounter, I think, in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 3, where the writer of the epistle addresses his words as follows, where he says, "Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession." He refers to his recipients, the readers of these letters, as his holy brothers, and of course, his holy sisters. Holy brothers and holy sisters. In Judaism, this was not an unusual in any way, not an unusual form of address to refer to one another as brothers and sisters, because the Jewish people are a large, extended family. And so in those days, it's not unusual to refer to one another in this kind of familial, tribal language, brothers, sisters. Paul does this form of address, brothers, you know, when he stands up in the synagogue. And the early believers adopted this same terminology. They adopted this terminology, and they adapted it within the movement in an even more defined and intimate way to refer to the fellowship of disciples, their fellow disciples of Yeshua. And it was our master himself who initiated this kind of language. One time his mother and his brothers came to speak to him in Capernaum, and they couldn't get to him. And stretching out his hand, it says in the gospel, toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers, and whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." These are the words of Yeshua. And he reinforced this familial type of language when he appeared after his resurrection to the women, and he said to them, "Don't be afraid. Go tell my brothers to go to Galilee." And again, he appeared to Miriam from Magdala, and he said, "Go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God." That's in the Gospel of John, of course. And with this type of language, Yeshua opened up this unique sonship relationship that he had always been expressing, this unique first-person father-son relationship he had with his father. He broadened it, so to speak, to include his disciples. And we learned this already, actually. We learned this in the previous chapter, in chapter 2 of Hebrews, where it said this in verse 11, that is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will sing of your praise. And therefore, we start reading, therefore, holy brothers and holy sisters, consider this. Consider Jesus, the apostle and the high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses also was faithful in all of God's house. So we're going to be talking about Moses apparently here, all right? Moses, Jesus. Consider Moses, consider Jesus. Consider Moses and Jesus. Why does the writer of the book of Hebrews refer to Yeshua as the apostle? Ordinarily, we think of the apostles as apostles. Not so much, you know, the master as an apostle. But the word apostolos means sent one. It refers to a messenger sent out in a mission as an agent of the sender. And it corresponds exactly to the Hebrew word shaliach, from the verb shalach, to send. And this is actually one of the, we don't use it much, but it's one of the most common terms that the master used to describe himself and his mission. That he is the one sent by the Father. He referred to himself as the one sent by the Father, and he referred to the Father very often by the title, he who sent me. The one who sent me. The Father who sent me. He who sent me. It's an oft-repeated phrase in the Gospel of John. I count more than 40 times in various formulas that Yeshua uses this language to describe God, the one who sent me. The sent one, this term, this title, the sent one, originally applied to Moses as the sent one, the one that God sent to Egypt to speak to Pharaoh, to redeem Israel. So it's a very natural title for the Messiah, who is the prophet, like Moses. A shaliach, a sent one in Judaism, refers to a legal agent, a representative that a man would dispatch on a mission to represent his interests. So, for example, a man sending out a shaliach, an agent, could imbue him with power of attorney to conduct business for him, so much so that a shaliach, your agent, you could send out an agent to betroth a woman for you. You know, you go out and say, go to such and such village, find such and such a girl, the daughter of so and so, and stand in for me and betroth that girl for me and get engaged to her on my behalf. Wow. Okay, so the sages said, they said it this way, a man's shaliach is like the man himself because he's his legal representative. The sender invested his shaliach with his identity and his authority. So the rabbis often referred to Moses, Elijah, and Elisha, and even Ezekiel as shlichim, that is, apostles, as apostles. Why? Because they all performed acts ordinarily performed by God alone. So this is, I think you can see why I'm saying this is a very appropriate title for the Messiah, the sent one, especially to allude to Moses, Messiah, who is also the sent one. Moreover, he refers to him as the high priest of our confession, which I think is another reference to Moses, who served as priest. We don't ordinarily think of Moses as a priest, but that's what he did. He served as priest before there was a priesthood. He installed his brother Aaron into the priesthood, and until Aaron and his sons were priests, Moses was carrying out the priestly duties of the sacrifices there in the first chapters of Leviticus, right? So I think, you know, both of these titles, you can see how these apply. Anyway, pressing on. We're reading here in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1, therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses also was faithful in all God's house. Now, when it says Moses was faithful in all God's house, We already visited this. I mean, we already talked about this a few weeks ago, but we're using this terminology, this term, house, in a double sense. In Hebrew, we can use it in a double sense. We can use it in other languages as well, to refer to a family. Your house is your family, or your household. We could say household, or the building in which the family lives, the house, right? So we can use it in both senses. The ancient household, the family, was composed of two types of people. There was the family members, the mom, the dad, the kids, the daughter-in-law, the grandchildren, the grandpa, you know, the family, and another tier of people called the slaves, the household slaves. This is the ancient household. And the slaves belonged to the household, were part of the household. They were part of the family, so to speak, but not the inner family. That's the metaphoric imagery that we're going to be playing here with in this passage. He says, regarding Moses, he was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses was in all his house. We're comparing Messiah and Moses. And there's an interesting subtlety here that it would be easy to read right over the top, and I was tempted to do so and to actually not stop and look at this, lest I bore you to tears. But I thought, no, we got to stop and look at this. Because we could read right over the top and totally miss that this is talking about King David. I mean, you didn't see King David there, did you? But this is talking about King David. We already looked at this text. So I've never saw this before. I was studying this yesterday. I said, oh, there's David. Where's David? Take a look with me. We can turn to 1 Chronicles 17. This is a text already cited by the writer of the book of Hebrews. He's already brought it up not so long ago. You're going to amuse me here by looking at this with me. You know the story. Nathan comes to David and he says to David, here's what Hashem said. Would you build a house for me to dwell in? You think you're going to build a house for me, David? I'm going to build a house for you. So David wanted to build the Lord a temple. The Lord came and he said, I'm going to build you a house. And your son will build me a house. Right? Remember that? Okay, so we're in 1 Chronicles 17, and I'm reading verse 10, the prophecy through Nathan. He says, I declare to you that the Lord will build you a house. And he uses house in the sense of family, dynasty. When your days are fulfilled to walk with your fathers, in other words, when you die, I will raise up your offspring, your seed, after you, one of your own sons, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for me, and I will establish his throne forever. I will be to him a father. He shall be to me a son. I will not take my steadfast love from him as I took it from him who was before you. But I will confirm him, or I will stand him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever. So this is the promise to King David, the promise of Solomon, the promise of the Davidic monarchy and dynasty, and specifically the promise of King Messiah, the seed of David, the son of David, right? All right, great. Now the writer of the Epistle of Hebrews alludes directly to this text. In fact, this version of it in 1 Chronicles rather than the one in 2 Samuel. He alludes to the 1 Chronicles version where it says, I will establish him in my house. In the Greek form, the Greek Septuagint version of 1 Chronicles here, the Hebrew it takes the Hebrew the Hebrew word ha'amadtihu. I will stand him, I will set him up, I will appoint him. You could translate, I will appoint him. And it translates it with this word, pistoso, which is, well, how do you say, faithful. It's, I will make him faithful, Or you could translate it as, I will establish him, I suppose. The writer of the book of Hebrews takes both of these, and here's how he says it. It's very interesting. When he says, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him. See, he takes both the Hebrew and the Greek and puts them together to allude to this passage. That's great. That's fabulous. So he just brought in King David. You didn't even notice. You didn't even notice that we're talking about this prophecy to King David here about building a house. So he goes on, he says, for he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. This is a little hard to follow. I'm back in Hebrews 3 if you didn't notice. This is a little hard to follow. But it actually follows a parallel structure, which makes some logical sense. He says Messiah is counted worthy of more glory than Moshe, than Moses. Just as the builder of a house has more honor than the house. Every house is built by someone. The builder of all things is God. God built creation, right? So just as we honor God more than we honor the creation, we honor the builder of the house more than we honor the house. And here we're talking household. The term builder of the house points to the prophecy we just read about the Messiah who will build the house, the dynasty of David, the messianic family. And this is being contrasted now, here's our second text, with another text, this time from Numbers 12. Well, you better go there. Numbers chapter 12. Because the writer of Hebrews says, now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. So it says, Moses is a faithful servant in God's house, or his household. And this is from Numbers 12. I just never saw this, you know, this connection, David, Moses, Chronicles, and Numbers, or Samuel. So it's pretty exciting for me. You have to let me enjoy this for a moment. So, because we have two passages building, we're connecting two different passages that really have nothing to do with each other whatsoever. We're connecting them on the basis of a common word, house, this concept of house, relating to God's household, or metaphorically to the temple, his house. But in one passage, the son of David builds the house. That's the one we looked at in Chronicles. And in another passage, the one we're looking at right now, Moses is a servant in the house. Okay, so you know this story. This is Moses, Aaron, Miriam complaining about Moses. God gives them the smackdown, and he says, now you listen here while I tell you something about my servant Moses. And he says in verse 6, if there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. My servant Moses is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord. So a few things here. This is a passage the rabbis cite to say that Moses received a level of prophetic revelation unsurpassed by any other prophet. To what can it be compared, the rabbis ask? The other prophets can be compared to a man looking through a dim mirror, an unpolished mirror, looking at a reflection in a dim, unpolished mirror. But Moses can be compared to a man who looked at a reflection through a polished mirror, through a clear mirror. This is what it says in the Midrash Rabbah. And it says, the other prophets are like men seeing an image reflected through nine lenses, but Moses, he's like a man who looks through one lens, you know, through one mirror. That's what it says in the Midrash Rabbah. But for all that, the passage says, my servant Moses, he is faithful in all my house. He's the servant of the Lord. as Hashem says in Joshua chapter 1, verse 2. He says to Joshua, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over the Jordan." Moses, my servant. So he's like the servant in the house. But he's the greatest of all the servants in the house. He's the chief servant. He's like Mr. Carson, right? The butler, you know, the butler. He's the butler of God's house. But he's not the heir. He's not the son. He's not the builder of the house. So back in Hebrews, we take these two passages and we're going to join them together. Like I taught you a few weeks ago about doing a midrash and conjunction, junction, you know, that sort of thing. We're going to stick these together here. In Hebrews chapter 3, verse 5, it says, "Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Messiah is faithful over God's house as a son." All right. That's a lot of work. Now, if this was a class, if this was a midrash written in a more structured way, like we would find in one of the collections, I think it would read more like this, a lot more clearly. How do we know that the Messiah will be more worthy of honor than Moses? The Holy One, blessed be He, spoke of Moses, saying, "My servant Moses is faithful in all my house." But He spoke regarding the son of David, saying, "He shall build a house for me, and I will establish his throne forever. I will be to him a father, he shall be to me a son." Now, who is greater, the servant over the household or the son of the household? Surely the son is more worthy of honor than the servant. Now, the builder of the household has more honor than the household, just as the creator has more honor than the creation. So the son has more honor than the servant. It reminds me very much of the midrash that we began with when we started studying Hebrews from Yalkut Shimoni regarding Messiah being where it says, "My servant will be high, lifted up, and greatly exalted, higher than Abraham, more lifted up than Moses, more greatly exalted than the angels." From Yalkut Shimoni, remember that one? So in previous chapters, we already established this, the superiority of Messiah over angels, right? Now we're talking about Moses. The superiority over Moses. Why? Well, Moses represents the Torah, the authority of the Torah. So if I was your, you know, a conventional Christian pastor, I suppose I'd look at this and I'd say, well, there you go again. Jesus cancels the Torah. There you have it. You know, we just set these up in opposition to one another. And you, I see the Old Testament, New Testament. New Testament comes, and you know, Old Testament's over, right? And it's like that's kind of how every passage just gets thrown into that box, right? Here comes the Son. Son doesn't have to do what the servant says. The servant says, "Keep the Sabbath." The son says, "I don't have to. I'm the son. You're the servant. You can't tell me what to do." So now we're no longer under the law. That's how we would understand that. That would be a conventional interpretation, but that's not the intention of the passage. The intention of the passage is to prove that Messiah is higher than Abraham, lifted up above Moses, and more exalted than angels. The intention is to say that if Abraham, Moses, and the angels are exalted, high, and holy, how much more so is the Son? In other words, if we take the Torah so seriously, he says, so seriously and so trustworthy that every transgression and disobedience receives a just retribution, how much more so do we need to take the Son seriously? It's not a deprecation, or it's not diminishing the Torah whatsoever. Instead, it's saying, if the Torah has authority, since it was put in place by angels, spoken by the chief servant over God's household, how much more so does the message that has come to us through the Son have authority over us? If Moses has authority in that he was the chief servant of the household, how much more so does the chief heir, the son of that same household, have authority? That's all we're saying. So it's not that he's doing away with the Torah or placing the Messiah up against the authority of Moses. Rather, the Messiah stands taller than Mount Sinai because he stands on top of Mount Sinai. And all of this is simply to warn us not to disregard him, not to fall away, not to turn away from the revelation that we receive from him, not to diminish him or consider him optional in our relationship with Hashem. He says, but Messiah is faithful over God's house as a son. And if we are his house, and we are his house, and we are his house, if, this is a big if, we are his house, if, that's a big if, we are his house, if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope. We are his house. God's house is a temple. That's the imagery. We are living. We are this living temple. We are this his household. We are his family, which is why he says, holy brothers. And the fraternity, and the sorority, if you prefer, this brotherhood, this sisterhood, extends to all disciples of our master, bringing us under one household, the household of God. And the one house, you know, this household is, of course, it extends to the whole family of Israel, the whole people of Israel, but the way that the master speaks and the way the apostles are using this terminology in this, we're speaking more specifically of a subset, a smaller subset of the nation, much the way that the sect of the Essenes referred to themselves as the Yahad, the unity, or the sect of the Pharisees referred to one another as Chavarim, friends, within their Chavura, their holy society. The Master's inner circle, his disciples, are a special family, brothers, sisters of the Holy Son. Therefore, holy brothers, holy sisters, sharing in a heavenly calling. And this is precious, you know, it's something we don't value. This fraternity of the discipleship, brotherhood of the disciples, sisterhood of the disciples. We're in this fraternity to enjoy this relationship of intimacy, sons and daughters of the fathers, if we hold fast our confidence. What's our confidence? Our confidence is he's the Messiah, that he's the Son of David, he's the one sent from the Father, he's the one risen from the dead. This is our confidence that he will bring the Messianic heir, the kingdom of heaven and life from the dead. That's our hope in which we boast. If we hold fast to this confidence and this hope, then God is our Abba. You know, that's how the Master referred to the Father. He had this special, intimate way of addressing his prayers. And his disciples would hear him talk like this. They'd hear him pray like this. And just this unique intimacy. He'd say, Abba, which is it's a little less formal than Av, Father. It's more like Papa, Papa. And this is how he would talk to God. He'd be like, Papa. It's this intimate relationship with his Papa. And he draws us into this when he makes us brothers and sisters and members of his house. Which is why, you know, as Bill Gaither would say, that's why we say brother and sister round here. You know, in today's Western world, family is it may be undervalued. Sacrifice for the sake of the almighty individual, right? Because in our culture, individualism, that's the important thing. The real holy grail is I just got to be me. But our master and his disciples never knew such a world. In their world, kids didn't openly disrespect parents. Siblings, you know, maybe fight with each other. Of course they fight with each other. But they would fight to defend the family honor first. A man had a fierce loyalty to his family name, his father's honor, his mother's honor, his brother, his sister, even his extended family. You know, the Bible's laws of redemption illustrate this concept really well. It goes out to father, brother, cousin, uncle. The biblical family model, family members have each other's backs. Got your back. You know, Jacob hates Esau. Esau hates Jacob. But that's inside the family. And when it comes down to it, Jacob would lay down his life to defend Esau from outsiders, and Esau would do the same to defend Jacob, because that's family. There's a Bedouin proverb that says, my cousin and I, you know, my cousin and I are enemies until there's a third enemy, and then we're friends. The same dynamic still exists among Palestinian Arabs. You ask a Palestinian Arab today, say, how large is your family? He replies, he says, well, we're a small family, you know, there's only 500 of us. And of course, he's counting, you know, all cousins, aunts, uncles, nephews, nieces. There's this strong sense of connection in the Middle East, you know, in that culture, the sense of loyalty, of obligation. I think the only way I can communicate this to you is if you saw the movie The Godfather. Did you see The Godfather? All right. If you didn't see The Godfather, it's all right. You know, I can't tell you as your pastor that you need to go see The Godfather. Well, it's got God in it. I don't know if you watch gangster movies, but I remember when I first saw The Godfather, I fell in love with it, not because of the gangster violence, but because of the strong family sense that was being communicated through the movie. That was the charm of the movie, and I think that's the thing that arrested people and made it so popular, especially back at that time when, you know, back in America, The Godfather came out at a time in American culture where family had pretty much fallen by the wayside. And the enchanting thing about the movie was this sense of family, this sense of belonging to the family, the Corleone family, right? And this sense of, because it was this old world values of family that had been imported from Sicily, from the Mediterranean world, you know, this, and dropped here in this culture, and this sense of obligation to the family's honor and responsibility to protect the family. You know, like the old saying, blood is thicker than water. I was 21 years old. I had this group of college-age friends that I thought would be my friends for life. You know, we were a band of brothers, artists, hippies, actors, musicians, and wannabes. And one of my brothers cautioned me and said, you know, they're all going to be gone in a few years, but we'll still be here. Which was true. It exactly turned out that way. Of those friends of mine, those comrades, those people that I thought were my inseparable companions on the adventure of life, the only one I am still in touch with to this day is the one that I married. Blood is thicker than water, but in the case of the brotherhood of the disciples, this is a blood bond. It's supposed to be a blood bond. We're made for family. We don't thrive. We don't do well as loners. We do well when we know we have a family. Avram Polyak's disciple, Erich Mueller, started orphanages in World War II, post-World War II Germany, taking in the troubled youth of Germany with orphans of Germany with one main principle, that the homes had to be real homes where the children would always know that they had some place to fall back on, that they had some place to come back to. And they were Sabbatarian homes because, you know, he was the disciple of a Messianic Jew. And so they kept the Sabbath, and they came around the Sabbath table together in these orphan homes because the holy tzaddik Erich Mueller wanted the orphans to experience family. And he believed that unless a person has family that he knows he can rely on, he will be unable to take risk and to take the psychological leaps and risks that it takes to grow, to attempt to achieve, because he has no safety net to fall back into. I know I'm digressing far from the text of Hebrews, but bear with me. You know, this is something that maybe we forget. Our holy brother Yeshua has brought us into a household That changes our relationships with one another. It was no coincidence that 2 days before his debilitating stroke, our brother Michael Newby stood up at the meal and thanked us, saying, "You are my only family. This is the family I have." Yeah, no coincidence. And of course, we're part of many families. You know, there's our families. We're part of the human family, sons of Adam, sons of Noah, distant cousins, brothers, sisters, human beings. And our master acknowledged that common humanity when he broadened the narrow commandment, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," which is a very narrow commandment. Your neighbor, your fellow Jew, "You shall love your fellow Jew as yourself." He broadened it to a wider application as, "You shall love your fellow human being as yourself." But at the same time, he introduced a narrower version of the commandment. And even he narrowed it when he said to his disciples at his last Seder, "A new commandment I give you, you shall love one another as I have loved you," which is even more than "you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Because assuredly, he loves us more than we love ourselves. We must love our neighbor and do unto every human being as you would have him do unto you. But when it comes to one another, to the fellowship, to the brotherhood, the attachment, the connection goes much deeper. And this is why it's so tragic when we lose a brother or sister, right? When a brother or sister leaves the master, because he or she leaves that inner circle, that tight inner circle, and moves into an outer circle, which is still family on another level, you know, on another level, family. We're all human beings, you know. This is one reason our master warns us. You know, don't take on the yoke of discipleship too quickly. Count the cost before you commit to this life. He warns that, he says, think long and hard about it. One man comes and says, "Well, first I got to deal with my family responsibilities. Got to bury my father." He says, "Let the dead bury the dead. You come follow me." Another man comes and says, "I'll follow you, but let me go say farewell to those at home." And he says, "No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom." It's a big responsibility. It's like getting married. When you marry someone, you marry the whole family, you know? You become part of that family. Most people don't think about this when they're getting married. They think it'd just be you and me, and they don't realize it. It's not like that. So we should always tell our children not to just look at the potential spouse, but also to look at the family, because you're going to be part of the family, and so will your children and their children after them. It's a huge leap. Now, discipleship calls for no less of a commitment, no less of a sense of loyalty to one another. If we're loyal to our earthly families, to our father and mother and brothers and sisters, how much more so do we owe loyalty to our heavenly family, to our spiritual family, the household of God, holy brothers, holy sisters, you who share in a heavenly calling. Consider this. Consider Yeshua, the apostle, the high priest of our confession, and our obligations within this family. Shabbat shalom.
Take on my yoke and learn from me. And find rest for your soul.